Tonight, it's anniversary night. The format of tonight's meeting will be a main speaker will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our information break and the anniversary celebrants. Our main speaker tonight is Woody.
Thank you. Wow, I'm pumped. I'm just really excited to be here. Normally when someone asks me to speak, I don't think about it until the day before. I'm Woody, I'm an alcoholic. But I've been thinking about what I'm going to say for the last 11 years, to be honest. I remember at 6 months, I was sitting in the back over there. You can get a seat back then in 2004. You can show up at 6:50 and there's still room in the back. And someone said, you need 10 years to speak here to be the 30-minute speaker. And I said, I can't wait to get 10 years. So here I am. I'm excited to be here. I have been sober since October 10, 2003. My home group's the Atlantic Group. I've got a sponsor, Michael B. I'm working the steps 9, 10, 11, 12. And I sit in the back up there on the left side. You get a great view. That's where my sponsor sits. That's where his sponsees sit. That's where my sponsees sit. So, there's a lot of friendly faces and welcoming people here. But I guarantee if you go up in the back over there, there's someone that's going to introduce you and make you feel really welcome. And I have to be careful with what I say because my dad's also in the audience. And So my perception of reality might be a little different from what he saw, but I'll just say how it was. I come from what is objectively just a lovely, lovely family. I mean, my parents are just wonderful people. A few people here know them, and they're just great. My brothers are amazing people. I think everyone in my family was sort of born with like a spirit of service, and I came out just like a jerk. I really did. I just had a bad attitude out of the womb and I thought it was abusive as a kid because I was always getting yelled at, but I was just always in trouble. You know what I mean? I didn't realize that until I got sober, but I was just always in trouble. And, I was a short, skinny, socially awkward dude who couldn't talk to girls, he couldn't talk to guys. I just felt really out of place. And I don't think that's what makes me an alcoholic. I think, there's probably a lot of socially awkward, teenage guys out there that aren't alcoholics, but probably what makes me an alcoholic is how I felt when I, the first time I drank. And I remember it clear as day. I was a freshman in high school, and the wrestling season had just finished, and one of the seniors asked me and two other freshmen to go to the end-of-year party that he had. And I remember feeling so proud that I was one of three freshmen who was asked to go, and I went, and I had a beer, and then I had a second, and then a third, and I was 5'3", 100 pounds, and I swear I grew like 12 inches. I was like, good looking, charming, athletic, funny. I was everything I always wanted to be in that moment. And at that point, like something clicked, and I realized that was, I was going to search for that feeling for the rest of my life. I knew at that point also that I couldn't stop how much, I couldn't control how much I drank that night. I drank until I got kicked out of the party. I didn't talk to any girl. I thought I talked to a lot of girls. I didn't really talk to any girls. I thought I was super fun and social. I really wasn't. I passed out in a corner. But I woke up and said, I can't wait to do that again. And the biggest impediment to that was, one, I didn't have friends that wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink, and I didn't have a lot of money, and my parents didn't let me out during the week. So it was tough, but once I made those friends and started getting a little bit more money, it became the driving purpose in my life. And by the time I drank with consequence from the beginning. By the time I was finished high school, I'd been hospitalized twice. I was always in trouble with the police. I was always getting drinking tickets there's always run-ins with them, always fighting. I was a blackout drinker by the time I finished high school. I drank by myself before I went to a pre-party to drink with other people before I went to a bar, and I drank until the money ran out or until everyone else went home, and then I would go home, and there was a bodega at across the street from my apartment that would sell $3 six-packs of Pabst Blue Ribbon, and this was before like the hipsters started drinking. It was like really not nice beer, and I would buy a six-pack on my way home by myself every time, and I would get through one or two of those and then pass out in my apartment, and my apartment was like littered with like half drunken six packs. I mean, and I had to hide them. I couldn't put them in the fridge. So I'd have, there were like 30 or 60 beers under my bed at any given time by the time I was a senior. But sports and my parents sort of kept me in check to the best that they could, and lack of money. And when I went to college, I got a good job that summer. I made a lot of money. I was able to save up, and I all of a sudden had no structure in my life. And I was just off to the races. And You know, what happened, you know, every time I drank in high school, I wanted to get drunk. And then what happened in college was there were times when I didn't want to get drunk, and I would. You know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I really wanted to get, I want to get really drunk. But Monday, sometimes I just wanted to watch a football game and, like, have two beers with my friends and be like a normal dude, and I would end up blacked out. You know, I couldn't control. And I started to see that there's times I didn't want to drink, and I would end up in a blackout at 4 a.m. by myself or with other people who drink like that on Tuesday nights. And so, you know, I realized there might be a problem, and I felt like the consequences got worse, the blackouts got worse. Just, you know, just it wasn't fun anymore, but I was doing it. I thought that's what normal people did, that they drank in high school, they drank a lot in their freshman year of college, and then they would sort of taper off. I thought the progression of life is sophomore year, you slow down, junior year a little more, senior year a little less, and then you're like a normal guy, and you have a career, and you get married, and just live life the way you're supposed to live it. And, you know, and I knew that the way I was living wasn't like a sustainable way of living. Like, you can't have a job and drink the way I drink, or you can't have a family or a girl. So I something was going to give. You know, I just thought I was just living the way a freshman college kid was supposed to live. And, you know, I got home from college my freshman year. My parents picked me up. I remember telling my parents, I think, how proud I was that I'd never been arrested. You know, I thought that was an accomplishment. And, you know, I get home that night, and then a couple of my high school friends call me up, and they invite me out, and 6 hours later, we're in jail. Six hours later, we're in jail, where you would get arrested. They sent us to the Tombs. There were four of us. Two of them are in attendance tonight. Two of the other guys are in attendance tonight. You know, but it was a big mess. It was a felony. It wasn't fun. They were questioning us, and, you know, it was something stupid. But, you know, I'm sitting in the Tombs thinking, like, man, how did I get here? My friend says, you know, I think I'm going to stop drinking. And you're like, but for, like forever? Or like, you know, he's like, yeah, I think I'm done. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. I think I'm done too. And I meant it. I really did. I did not want to go back to jail. So I get out and I'm done. I'm like, I'm going to quit drinking. And I tried really hard. I thought that the way I would quit drinking was by working a lot. And it would work for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. I would, you know, I was a doorman that summer, and I would take these double shifts, and I would stay sober because all I did was work and sleep. But the one night I would drink after 3 or 4 weeks, I would like get blacked out and miss work again. You know, it's just. And at that point, after going to jail, it was not fun. It was not like a pleasant experience, and I really wanted to stay sober. I go back to college for my sophomore year. My first night back, I told everyone I quit drinking. Someone offers me like a cup of coffee with a shot in it. It was so stupid. And I said, yeah, why not? And then I end up in jail that night again. You know, a buddy and I, we get arrested together. And then I get out. I was in a fraternity. I thought I could be sober in a frat. We had Hell Week. We make it through. We get initiated. And we have a couple more drinks. And then I wake up the next morning. I have a black eye. The same guy I got arrested with. We both wake up with matching black eyes the next morning. I mean, it was just the jig, you know, it was coming to an end. I knew it. But I tried so hard. I tried so hard to stay sober. And no matter how hard I tried, I just kept on getting knocked down again. My dad took me to an AA meeting and said it was the best known solution for the recovery of alcoholism. And I didn't believe it. I thought, you know, if you want to get sober, you just do it. Otherwise, you know, I didn't know. I tried for about 2 months, and I just got to a point where I'd given up. I called my mom one day, and I said, you know what, I'm done. I'm going to join the Army. That seemed like a good idea. And she came, and not to disrespect the Army, I told her that. She said, you're coming home. And she brought me home. You know, at this point, I still have these, like, legal charges pending, and things are kind of a mess. So if you want to live at home, you need to stay go to an AA meeting every day. And at that point, it was October. So I got sober October 10th, 2003. At that point, the Yankees were in the playoffs. I wanted to watch them play, so I'd go hang out with my friends, watch the Yankees play, and then and I'd tell my parents I went to a meeting, and one day my mom like sat me down, and she said, what meeting did you go to? And I made something up, and she broke out a meeting book and said, all right, like let's see. And I tried my best to lie, and I knew she didn't believe me. So the next day I went to an AA meeting because I thought she was following me. No, and my mom, I mean, she's a tough Italian woman. Like, I'm afraid of my mom. I mean, she loves me so much, and she might have been following me. It wouldn't surprise me because she would do anything to get me sober. So I went, and I came to AA because you know, like a lot of us, I just came to get the heat off. I was just, there's so much going on. I just wanted everyone to back off. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to stay sober for a couple months, just like get everything under control again. Then I'd be able to start drinking normally and having fun. And, you know, I always wanted to be that, like, a fun social guy when I drank. I didn't want to be a blackout drunk. I wanted to drink and, like, be able to laugh with the guys and, like, talk to girls and just have a good time. And I was never that guy. But I thought I could just stay sober in AA for a couple months and be that guy. And I don't know what happened, but around 3 weeks, I just, you know, I was 19 years old. 3 weeks, I realized, like, it's over. I'm an alcoholic. I'm never, like, for whatever reason, I was graced with, like, a moment of clarity. I realized, that, like, I'm in this for life. You know, whether I'm sober for the rest of my life or not, I'm going to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, at 30, I'm going to be in AA with 6 days or 10 years, but I'm going to be here. I can't outrun this disease. And for whatever reason, that, like, you know, that truth sunk into my heart, and I just realized I'm done. I'm just going to do it because there's no alternative. So I just did what people told me to do, and I went to AA meetings every day. I had no, you know, I was unemployable at the time. I had nothing else to do. I couldn't see my old friends. I did a lot of fellowship. I smoked a lot of cigarettes. I drank a lot of milkshakes. I don't know. I did what I thought I had to do to stay sober. For whatever reason, at the meetings I went to, I just didn't hear enough about sponsorship or the steps. And I'm not going to blame those other meetings. I just didn't hear it. That didn't mean it wasn't said. I might not have been ready. And what I realized, you know, in those first sort of four or five months of sobriety is my life got significantly worse. You know, my parents were not, they're still not thrilled with the person I was. I mean, I thought I was going to get a cookie for being sober, and they wanted to kick me out of the house because I was still a lying scumbag. You know, I was still like a terror to live with. You know, I at least drinking gave me like temporary relief from my rage and alcoholism, and I didn't have that anymore. So I just got angrier and angrier and rage and more depressed. I didn't have the guts to kill myself, but I just prayed that a truck would like take me out every time I walked home from a meeting. Somehow I ended up at this meeting because someone told me it was strict. The meeting's not, that's a lie. I mean, the meeting's not strict. There's structure to this meeting, but no, you know, the meetings aren't strict. But I came here, you know, I always do well with structure. And so I came here and my sponsor found me and just started telling me what to do. My sponsor and I have like nothing in common. You know, he had nothing I wanted, but he just told me what to do. So he told me to pray. He told me to read the book. He told me to say "Thy will not mind me done" all day, every day. When I missed a train, say it. Do this. Do that. I just did it. I was so desperate. I just wanted to get better. You know, I knew that if I went to a meeting, I could grind out a day of sobriety. You know, I went to a meeting in fellowship. I could just grind it out. But that's not, to be honest, that's not how I wanted to live my life. I mean, I was 20 at the time. I have 60, 80 more years in me. Like, I don't want to grind out living. Like, I want to actually enjoy it. And I would see you people smiling, and I didn't believe you were alcoholics, because if you're an alcoholic the way I am, the thought of not drinking again doesn't give you a smile. It's like terribly depressing. I didn't have a program for living. And my sponsor gave me that. He brought me through the steps, and I just did what he said because I had no alternative. Drinking didn't work. Grinding it out in meetings didn't work. And after a few weeks of prayer, I felt something. I believed in God, but I felt something that told me it would be okay. And I just did everything with the desperation of a dying man, because there was just no alternative. You know, I'm not a low bottom drunk in the traditional sense, but I am in the sense that there's just no illusion that there is anything out there for me. Like I am an alcoholic to my core. So I got back into college. And I was going to go away that August. And I knew if I didn't get my four step done and fifth step done before school, I was never going to get it done. Like, I was going to get, there were going to be new friends, new priorities, homework. I needed to get this four step done before I went away, or I was going to drink. I mean, and that's kind of how, like, you know, I treat sobriety. If I don't get this done, I'm going to drink. And so I treat things with that urgency. I got my four step done, did my fifth step. There were all these things I thought were so terrible, and actually haven't heard a lot of fifth steps there. They're like really boring, but you know, I did it, and after doing the fifth step, I thought, man, there's a place for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't really feel a ton of relief, but I knew that there was a place, and I started making these amends, and that's when I really started believing that I belong here, and there's a solution to long-term sobriety and happiness. When I got sober at 20, I mean, I thought it was over. I really did. I mean, I thought I was never going to have fun again. I thought it was, you know, the ride, you know, I was just okay with living a miserable life as long as I didn't have to drink again. I would do whatever it took. There were no conditions on my sobriety that I have to have fun or therefore, no, whatever, I'm done. And what I realized was my life was, it's just been such a roller, in a great way, it's such a roller coaster. I went to West Texas to go to school. I made a ton of great friends. I got a sponsee down there named Andrew T. He's been my sponsee for about 8 years now, going strong. If you can stay sober in Lubbock, Texas, you can stay sober. Sober anyway. I have the dearest friends in my, amazing people in my life that I met down there. But I'll tell you what, I got there and I didn't like it because it wasn't the Atlantic Group and they did sobriety differently. And I would go to meetings and just kind of judge the meeting structure and judge the speaker and do all this stuff. And everyone does AA differently. But at the end of the day, it's really about service. You know, I've been sober now like 11 years or a little over 11 years. And when I'm not doing service, sobriety gets really stale. AA meetings get really stale. I've heard a lot of what I'm going to hear. And you always hear new things and things that blow your mind. But for the most part, like on a day-to-day basis, I've kind of heard it. What keeps AA fresh and what keeps it amazing and what gives it makes it very joyful for me is service. That's when it's fun. That's where the magic happens. And so I spent the first year in Lubbock, Texas, kind of judging it and miserable and kind of going to meetings so I could tell my sponsor I was going to a meeting and then being not terribly happy with how things were. And I don't know why I decided to change that, but I did after about a year down there and I just dove into service. And I had a crew of like 6 or 7 sponsees that were calling me and following me all over the place by the time I graduated. And, I'll tell you what, being an alcoholic, I never learned how to like talk to people or like live like, I never like matured in a normal way. And I remember my sponsor telling me, he's like, all right, you're in college now. It's like where we grow up. So you're going to make friends and you're going to talk to girls and you're going to, that aren't in AA. He said, how do I do that? And he says, no, you just go up to them and smile and tell, say hi. And I said, no, I can't do that. It's so lame. I can't go up to a guy and say, hey, I'm Woody. Like, can you be my... It's what I do now. At 31, I have a ton of friends. I just, if I see someone I want to be friends with, I say hi and I'm Woody. He says, go, if you want to meet a girl, you go smile at her and say hi. And I said, no, I can't do that. It's so lame. And you know what? It works. It works. I heard a speaker here talking about how he didn't think he had a design, the rule book for living. But his 7-year-old daughter did, and he asked his 7-year-old daughter, how do you do it? How are you so popular? And he says, when I see someone I want to be my friend, I just go up to her and say, hi, I'm so-and-so. It's so crazy, but I thought I needed alcohol to live and to be a normal, functioning member of society. Everything I drank for, I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and so my life has just been so much fun. I've been taking road trips across the country. I moved to Mexico after I graduated, through a sponsee, or through one of my sponsor's sponsees back in the day, he was Mexican, he basically got me a job in Mexico. I said, why not? I'm, 23, no girlfriend, no debt, no car, let's do it. And I moved down there, and, I was very plugged into the Alcoholics Anonymous community. Some of the best friends I have to this day, I met in Alcoholics Anonymous, at Mexico Alcoholics Anonymous, and actually, I'm going to Mexico this weekend for a wedding for a dude I met, one of my buddies down there, and one of my old sponsees is going to be there. I'm super excited, but my life has been so much fun. The sober dances, I'll say the Atlantic Group dances are a ton of fun, but you guys, you have nothing on Bogota, Colombia sober dances. Those guys really got the sober dancing thing. Even the old people were out till 6 in the morning. It was just so much fun. I have had so many experiences, it's got to be about, you need service, and I need to interrupt my life because my thinking will kill me. And when it's all about me, I become angry, resentful, jealous, fearful, and the only thing that stops that from happening is working with others and interrupting my life. Around 7 years, I was living in Mexico. Things were going great. I had a job at a firm that, would never... It was a dream job, and I met this really pretty like señorita, and things were going great, and you know, then we got married and, you know, things were awesome. But, you know, all of a sudden, like, you know, I was working 90 hours a week. And then, you know, I couldn't really go to meetings during the week because I was working so much. And on the weekend, well, I had to hang out with my, you know, my fiance or, you know, wife. So I couldn't, you know, take time away from her and go to meetings. And all of a sudden, my meeting attendance just, you know, it plummeted. And not just my, everything. My thoughts were all about myself and my, you know, it was all about me. And you know, and for the grace of God, by the grace of God, I didn't drink. But, you know, but those weren't the greatest years of my life. And I came back to New York in 2012. I came back to go to business school here in the city, and also to sort of reconnect with, you know, with my folks and my city, and also because I realized, like, the working 90 hours a week, 100 hours a week wasn't a great thing long term, you know. And at that time, you know, my marriage, I'd been married for about a year, and it just started to crumble. And not because of my meeting, it for things that were out of my control. I mean, all the meetings in the world wouldn't have saved this. But, you know, I remember thinking, you know, if this has to end, I really need God by my side. Like, if I have to make the decision to, like, walk away from this, like, I really need a God by my side. So I, you know, I plunged, you know, I dove into service and God in a way that I never had. You know, I'd always prayed, but not religiously. You know, I occasionally was too late and, you know, running late, and I would skip a prayer or I would skip a meditation. And with these, like, really important decisions in my life coming up or events coming up, I prayer and meditation became non-negotiable. All the home groups became non-negotiable. All the AA stuff became non-negotiable. And at the end of the day, you know, the marriage failed and, you know, such is life. It was terrible. But it was like the happiest time of my life because, you know, not the happy, it wasn't joyful, but I had serenity, I had happiness. I moved in with my folks, and I let my parents take care of me. I never let my parents take care of me and love me. I was always so anxious to run away and, like, you know, always, like, thinking I'm independent. And at 29, I, like, needed someone to take care of me. And my parents were there and, you know, and they cooked for me every night. It was amazing. And, you know, and then since then, I've sort of gotten back on my feet and I'm sort of single and have a job again. And things are great, but, you know, the serenity hasn't changed. The happiness hasn't changed. You know, I'm still going to the same amount of meetings, and that's a lot. I've got a ton of sponsees. I do a lot of service. And I'll tell you what, it's a very powerful thing to be able to walk through really difficult circumstances and know that your happiness won't be affected, know that your serenity won't be affected. Not that you will be happy about these things, but you know, it's just very freeing and empowering to know that whatever God throws at me, you know, I just got whatever life throws at me, I've got a really, really powerful God who's got my back. Doesn't mean that life won't happen. You know, tragedy has to happen to someone, so why not, you know, me at some point? But I've got a really powerful God who's got my back, and all I have to do is just interrupt my life, and be of service. I remember once at six years sobriety, I thought, man, I'm so busy, I can't really go to that many meetings. You know, I got to go to the gym, and then the girl, and then all of a sudden. Man, if I told you, I wake up at 5 in the morning, I work out, I go to meetings, I've got a ton of friends in and outside of the rooms, I occasionally date people and occasionally not, but my life is just full. It is full. But what doesn't change is I'm here every Tuesday night, Tuesday is non-negotiable. Bagels and Big Book, if I'm in town, non-negotiable. I don't switch meetings to, like, hang out with friends or to go on a date or to, non-negotiable. My sponsor asked me to do something. It's almost always service-related. I do it. You know, and that's the reason I'm sober 11 years. You know, over 11 years is because, you know, when I was 6 months sober and trying not to kill myself, my sponsor told me to do something. No matter how ridiculous it sounded, I did it. At 11 years, he tells me to do something. He suggests me that I do something for AA, and I might, like, complain a little bit, but I do it anyway. You know, I've got the same desperation that I had at 6 months, at 3 months. I just do not want to drink, and I know I'm an alcoholic. I mean, it's a real thing, and I have it. And I share this story, but I think about 6 months ago, I went out with this girl, and you know, she was asking me why I don't drink, and sometimes I just tell people I don't really care that much, but, like, yeah, because I'm an alcoholic. I go to AA meetings, and whatever, like. And she did not get it. She just could not understand this. She's like, you know, I'm telling her these stories, and she's like, it sounds like you're an idiot 19-year-old. You know, and yeah, I was, but, like, you know, but she just did not understand what alcoholism was and that it was a real thing and that I had it. And that's good, because she doesn't have to understand. Like, you know, it doesn't matter. But I drop her off, and I'm walking home, and I pass by this, you know, this homeless guy, And he says something to me. I thought, oh no, he's going to ask me for money. And he's got no legs. He's covered in vomit, and I think he's asking for money. And instead, he pulls out $2. He says, "Can you go in that deli right there and buy me a beer?" You know, with the only energy that this guy could muster up and is to pull out $2 from his pocket and ask me to get a beer. So I went in and got him a beer because the guy needed it. But you know, a normal person sees that guy and just. He sees him like an alien or a foyer. I saw him and I saw my future. I mean, I identified with that. I know what it's like to not be able to move, and all I can think about is how I can like manage to tilt the beer can into my. I saw my future. You know, that's why at 10 years, 11 years, I'm still doing this, you know, 4 or 5 times a week. And that's why I'm, you know, taking all these phone calls and doing all the service. I mean, alcoholism is a real thing, and I have it. And I'll tell you what. If you're here tonight, you really won the lottery. I mean, we are just so blessed. I walk around every day thinking how lucky I am. I'm just so grateful to be here. I love the Atlanta Group. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and thanks so much.